Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 26th of January 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. Well, yesterday we had an exclusive news talking about the fact that Britain's nuclear deterrent is going to be handed over to the French first. It will then be passed under full European Union control. And of course, who will be controlling the military in Europe? That comes down to the Germans. We're going to be joined again. We're going to be joined today by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives that wrote that paper exposing just what was going on. We're also delighted to say that we've got Vanessa Beely with us, who's going to be giving us an update on Syria. Well, before we bring Vanessa in, we just thought we would return to the subject of Britain's prisons, because, of course, Elizabeth Truss has made an announcement today about deaths in prisons. Before we come on to that, let's remind people that child abuse survivor and whistleblower Melanie Shaw, still in HM prison, Foston Hall. She's been held in solitary confinement now for 9.5 months. She's been brutalised, denied medication. I've repeated this over and over again. Of course, the UN and indeed the European Union, for that matter, says that holding people in solitary confinement is effectively torture. We've been encouraging people to contact Melanie's MP, her personal MP, who's Chris Leslie. We had a call from an individual yesterday that said they had attempted to speak to Mr. Leslie about the dreadful conditions that Melanie's being held in and what's happening to her. Mr. Leslie was so concerned he put the phone down. So we're saying to people, please, like this letter from this lady, Gillian Swanson, really excellent letter to Chris Leslie. If we're going to do something for Melanie, let's get on the case of Chris Leslie MP. Let's be phoning him. Let's be emailing him, visiting his surgery, and making sure that he knows this issue is not going to go away and will certainly appear at the next election. But good news, the government says there's been a sharp rise in deaths in prison. This is really appalling stuff. If we have a look at what the government is saying, most of it is a crowing by Justice Secretary Elizabeth Truss. She says since becoming Justice Secretary, she's been clear that violence, self-harm and deaths in our prisons are too high. Then says she's taken immediate action to stabilise the estate by tackling drugs, drones and phones, and that undermines security. We're also investing 100 million in 2,500 officers, but they're long-standing issues, and we're going to do our best to reduce crime, etc. But it's going to take a long time, Mike.
Yes.
So if we look at the document here, and encourage people to get hold of this. It basically says that deaths are up, self-harm is up, everything is up. And this is because, of course, we've now got chaos in Britain's prisons as more and more people are crammed in. And many of those prisons, of course, are not there to help those prisoners serve their sentence and then lead better lives. They're there to make private companies profit. So deaths are up. And here's the stats. 2016 has seen a record level of 354 deaths in prison custody, which is up 97 from the previous year. And there was a record high of 119 self-inflicted deaths, which is up 29 from the previous year. So have a look at these statistics yourself and remember that this is the Gulag prison system of Britain. Run now by Theresa May's Conservatives, the same Conservatives that are telling other nation states, such as Syria, for example, how to run their own countries. Well, let's remind ourselves of what Elizabeth Truss looks like. Here she is, Justice Secretary. Just a small point, she doesn't have any training at all. If we can put that one on screen.
Sorry.
Here she is. I've just translated what she said because she's got words that have come out in the government report. But really what she's saying, she's going to tackle prison security, transform prisons by recruiting more low-wage, untrained staff, because that's what's happening, and she's going to reduce offending and keep communities safe by more prisoners killing themselves. That solves the problem pretty quickly. And by locking up child abuse whistleblowers, all for profit. So if you can't understand what the government's actually saying, you need to translate Liz Truss's newspeak, and you find out the sheer horror of it.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to Syria. Vanessa has been in Helsinki in Finland at this event, supporting Syrians and the region. This is run by the United Nations. They say that the event aims to present the objectives, contents and achievements of the Regional Resilience and Refugee Plan, which is 3RP, and the humanitarian and resilience priorities inside Syria. The United Nations agencies and NGO partners are appealing, they say, for $4.63 billion in new funding to continue vital work in addressing the global needs of refugees from Syria and communities hosting them in neighbouring countries. The UN and more than 240 partners formally launched the Regional Refugee and Resilience Plan, 3RP, for 2017 and 2018. The plan aims to assist over 4.7 million refugees from Syria and 4.4 million people hosting them in Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq and Egypt. The funding for the 3RP is in addition to the $3.4 billion that the UN estimates will be required to address the humanitarian needs of 13.5 million people within Syria this year. So, Vanessa, let's get straight to it. You were attending this event. Was it a worthwhile exercise?
Yeah, it was an extremely worthwhile exercise in investigation into the Global North interventionist policy into the Global South generally, and also an extraordinary exercise in seeing firsthand the privatization of humanitarianism and the weaponization of humanitarianism. There was a very clear inclusion of the private sector and how best the private sector could, reading between the lines, benefit from such reconstruction projects. And also a very clear objective of decentralization. I'm just going to read to you from this panel brochure for the day. Capacity building among women, men, and youth will also be a major priority. This will include support for local and regional NGOs to help them contribute to reconstruction, to facilitate protection programming, and to receive funds directly from the international community. Now that, you know, it sounds wonderful, right? Local NGOs prioritizing Syrians. But nowhere in any of these panels or any of these sessions was there any clarification as to exactly who these NGOs were, to what extent they are working within the Syrian state, the existing Syrian state, and what exactly their role would be, and who was overseeing this project. Also, another point that I need to make very strongly, this was a conference supposedly supporting Syria and the Syrian people. There were precisely four Syrians at this conference, two of which are very clearly funded, one by Qatar, that is effectively funding the terrorist factions inside Syria, and another embedded in Idlib and clearly affiliated with the majority of the extremist factions that are, of course, funded by the NATO states that are backing this conference and are behind the UN in this project.
Right. So if we just look at some of the panels, here's one, humanitarian and resilience priorities inside Syria. Mm. Whose priorities is the first question. Background paper, vulnerabilities, jobs and economic opportunities, Syria and neighboring countries. Well, who are these economic opportunities for? And then another one here, never too early to plan is what it's subheaded. And, you know, so the question is, I think you've hinted at this. Who is doing the planning? Who's it being planned for? And clearly, from what I read of this, it's really nothing to do with Syria and everything to do with the NGOs and sort of vested interests that are sort of going in there to take advantage of the situation.
Absolutely. And you know, we've clearly demonstrated over many years that the NGOs, I actually now call them NNGOs, non-governmental organizations, because we know them to be a member or a part of the mafia triangle of the corporatocracy, the globalist elite, who create the foundations in order to then fund and create these NGOs that take public money and basically launder it back around the system again. So effectively to say that particularly if it's external NGOs, but even if it's NGOs that have been established inside Syria by the NATO states and the international community external to Syria, it basically has the same effect. It's the infiltration of Syria by the private sector, by the venture capitalists. And another sort of demonstration of the cynicism of this conference was during that panel, Helen Clark, who was a previously MP in New Zealand, was actually discussing the difficulties of lifting the economic sanctions in order to facilitate this reconstruction process. Now, this reconstruction process would not be necessary had there not been these crippling economic sanctions in the first place that are effectively only devastating the Syrian civilian population, or the NATO state engineered dirty war that is being waged against Syria. So in other words, destroy the country and then let's profit from the rebuilding of it. It's a very familiar pattern.
Right. Well, you mentioned Helen Clark there, who's the ex-Prime Minister of New Zealand. Let's get a feeling for what she's about, because you asked her a question. I believe this is during the ending press conference. So let's have a look at this and then we'll discuss it.
This lady back there.
Good afternoon. My name is Vanessa Beattie. I'm an independent journalist, photojournalist. I would just like to clarify regarding the rebuilding process that has been discussed over the last 2 days and the inclusion of the private sector. I spent about 3 months last year in Syria, including during December. I was there for the liberation of East Aleppo from the Nusra Front-led occupation. What I was hearing from both the Syrian state representatives and from the Syrian people on the ground is that the priority partnerships would be with their allies, Russia, China, and Iran, for the rebuilding process, particularly in Aleppo. So I'm interested to hear who has actually invited the nations that are attending here to participate in the rebuilding process, and which private sectors are being negotiated with for those rebuilding contracts inside Syria.
Well, the focus here, of course, is not on rebuilding because there isn't a political settlement. The focus here is very much on meeting the needs of Syrians in Syria for relief and for resilience and for refugees beyond the border and the host communities there. Now, you know, we all here would want to see the conflict in Syria end. At that point, there will be some configuration of government. We cannot say what that will be. The recovery and reconstruction process will have to be Syrian-led. And then whoever wishes to partner that will, of course, be in contact with those who govern. But in essence, this meeting is not about those issues. This meeting is about the here and now. And I think what we're all indicating is that even were there to be a political settlement tomorrow, we would still be here seeking support for humanitarian relief for a country that has been brought to its knees with 85% living in poverty, 50% in unemployment, and with these severe economic and social impacts on the neighbourhood. So we will still be working at that level, just whatever other conversations are going on about how Syria would be reconstructed and recover.
So, Vanessa, you know, she's saying that there can't be any effort to recover in Syria until there's some kind of political settlement. But correct me if I'm wrong, but there's already efforts to rebuild and so on in Syria with or without the help of the United Nations Development Group, which she chairs. What planet is she living on?
Not a very happy one when I was allowed to ask that question. The expressions on the faces of the priority panelists there, including Stephen O'Brien, who was next one along from her, who, of course, has been vociferously calling for a no-fly zone and further intervention in Syria. She hedged the question. I mean, that was very clear. She didn't respond to the question. She also made the extraordinary statement that she really stumbled over the political solution because she really did not want to say that they were negotiating with the existing elected government in Syria. So they're still clinging to this transitional stage argument, which, as you said, is being made a mockery of by the Astana peace talks that are being hosted by Russia, Turkey, Iran, and Syria, and that are ongoing at the same time as this conference. And no mention of those peace processes and that peace talk were mentioned at the conference. And yes, when I was in Syria during December, the Chinese envoys were there purely to discuss the rebuilding process, particularly in Aleppo. So it was just, they're living in a parallel universe. Unfortunately, that parallel universe is becoming more and more visible to the people that have a true understanding of what the situation is and what their objectives are, despite all of the academic and very sort of eloquent language with which they veneer over it.
Just before, Brian has a question, but just before that, people are asking in the chat box if that video is available on YouTube. It is, and I'll put the link in the notes for this the column website and also on the YouTube channel.
Well, I can also give you a link to the whole, because they can actually, that was a cut down version, but there is a link I can send you to the whole final speech.
Okay.
Vanessa, I just wanted to say, really excellent question, and to see that that woman just sort of, what's the word, filibuster, I think it is. She didn't know what to say. But you've pinned down the situation. Basically, we've got the Russians and the Chinese, Iran, invited in on the ground to a nation state, Syria. The Syrians are saying they want to work with these people. And then we've got the sideliners. So you're talking about this project 3RP, backed by the United Nations. We're also picking up on Federica Mogherini holding similar sideline meetings for the European Union, talking about how the European Union is going to help Syria. And of course, in her dialogue, she says very clearly, well, of course, in the future, we'll be helping Syria because there will have been transformation of Syria. And if you read the text, it's not difficult to get the facts out of that text. What she's really saying is we'll be helping Syria once we've achieved transformation, which is regime change. So the agenda of these people is they're sitting on the sidelines stalling because they've got to get rid of Assad before they can get their geopolitical agenda into Syria. That's my feeling on it.
Yeah, and I think it's even more cynical than that. If you can get any more cynical than that. In the sense that they know perfectly well that the symbolism of the fall of Aleppo meant the fall of their regime change plans fundamentally, because that entire liberation of East Aleppo, the reunification of East and West Aleppo, exposed the corporate media, the NATO-aligned NGOs, the UN, and the Western regime and Gulf state Israeli objectives in the region very clearly, and the level to which they had misrepresented facts on the ground in Syria for the last 6 years. So they are flailing around. And now, of course, we see smart power, soft power being used at the start of any of these interventionist predatory campaigns. But now we're seeing it being used as a desperate measure at the end to try and infiltrate through, they say, local NGOs. But we can almost guarantee that those local NGOs will only be in terrorist-held areas. They certainly did not show any indication that they were going to be working with existing Syrian state NGOs. And, you know, we have to be very clear here. They talk about the three the three RPs. Among that is obviously their focus, as Helen Clark said at the end and when she responded to my question, focus on refugees and on helping those that have been displaced. Well, you know, I would also have liked to have asked them, okay, so since the liberation of East Aleppo, where exactly is the UN? The only countries providing humanitarian assistance right now in East Aleppo are Russia and Syria to its own people. The UN has not been seen. It was not there when I was there during December, and it has not been back to East Aleppo since the liberation. So again, this just demonstrates the cynicism of this organization. A city, a village, a town, a people only become important on a humanitarian basis when it serves their objectives geopolitically and the objectives of the UN Security Council.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, we've got to move on through a couple of things here. We wanted to highlight Tulsi Gabbard's interview with CNN, which you've covered on 21st Century War here. I have to say, I was quite impressed with how she managed to say some pretty strong things without getting herself into too much trouble with CNN. But the CNN interviewer certainly looked distinctly uncomfortable with some of the things she did say. Just quickly on this, Vanessa, please.
Well, I mean, I think that the main point that came out, and of course, this comes on the back of her Stop Arming the Terrorists bill, which again caused some major shockwaves in Congress. But she makes the very clear point, there are no moderates. And to hear a congresswoman make this point on the CNN platform, it was a breath of fresh air, because we've been saying this pretty much for the past 6 years. To hear it said publicly on CNN, there are no moderates in Syria, and to hear it said in context that this is what the Syrian people say, it was wonderful. I can't think of any other way to describe it. And you're right, the CNN, I can't remember his name, but the CNN interviewer was flawed.
Yes. okay. And of course, lots of success with the White Helmets in getting them, preventing them getting the Nobel Peace Prize. But unfortunately, they have been nominated, or at least this so-called documentary by Netflix has been nominated for an Oscar. I think we've got a bit of work to do to prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Yes, I think we're going to start a pretty strong campaign. We have, of course, Carla Ortiz, who was in East Aleppo at the same time as myself. She's a Bolivian-born Hollywood actress and activist. And she's actually working with us to get to the root of the problem, let's say. But I also want to make a very clear point to everybody that this is a campaign that has been engineered right from the start. If we go back to a Syria campaign, purpose.com job application form last year, March last year, where they made it absolutely clear they were going to go for an Oscar nomination for a documentary that was going to be made in the next 12 months. So, you know, there can be no doubt that this is an entirely manufactured, manipulated PR campaign. And we should be doing everything. We'll be producing petitions. We'll be producing campaigns to expose it and to boycott it over the next few weeks. So I hope people will give the same support as they did to the Nobel Peace Prize when we derailed it. The public derailed it. So we can do it again. I have no doubt.
Yep. Okay. Fantastic.
Right. OK, well, Vanessa, I'm just going to bring in a little bit of research that we've been doing for BBC Media Action. BBC Media Action is supposedly a charity, but in fact, it's a proxy arm of the BBC. That's very easy to prove. And I just want to take you through a little trail of things that we found. First of all, put down the baseline. We've had this article up on the UK column website since 1st July 2014. This is exposing what this pernicious little charity has really been up to. We say it's subversion from Broadcasting House to Kazakhstan. Evidence-based report there about the dirty work of this charity, which is essentially getting inside countries and then helping to cause what they call the change agenda. But actually, you're attacking law and order, the nation state. Now, we picked up on this lady. This statement is still on the BBC Media Action website. If you look at the Syria section, But in 2004, this so-called expert on Syria, Juliet Harkin, said that in 2004, the BBC Media Action worked with individuals within the Syrian ministry who wanted change and tried to get them to be the drivers of that. All media development work that has been done in Syria has, in my opinion, been predicated upon this idea. There can be change from within. You have an authoritarian regime and you find who the reformers are within that and you work with them. Now, to me, this lady is describing subversion. The BBC's buried itself inside Syria, says it's there to train young journalists. But in this lady's own words, what they're really doing is working from the inside to cause unrest and dissent against the government. Just a quick reply on that, and I'll just take you through the other couple of bits.
Well, I mean, this is in a very recent debate that I had on social media with James Longman, who's a reporter or a presenter with the BBC. He was actually embedded in the suburbs of Homs and Damascus in 2011 when the so-called peaceful revolution started. Now, he was embedded in areas where probably the most atrocities were committed by the extremist and militant factions at that time. When I questioned him on that, and I actually said to him, OK, so you were in Homs at the same time as Danny Abdeldayem, who was the citizen journalist who was exposed as faking information on the bombing by the Syrian government. He claimed that he had been in those areas. He had seen no extremists. When you actually read his reports from the areas at that time, they're quite extraordinary. He makes no investigations. He basically disseminated narratives from rebel activists that we now, of course, know there were no moderates. There are no moderates. So these were militant extremists. So again, that's a very clear indicator that the BBC was there on the ground right from the start. And he had no journalistic experience, but he spoke fluent Arabic. So this is a very clear implantation, embedding of a journalist that is then going to not only disseminate the narrative that facilitates the regime change, but also is there possibly to train and to help existing citizen activists, as they're called. And he also made a point in one of his interviews that they had incredible technological ability and capacity. Now, where did that come from?
Well, that probably came from money being poured in, for example, from the European Union. Just take you through the next bit. This is an organisation which is a part essentially of European Union Foreign Office, if you like. It's the European External Action, and it's been funding a whole number of projects in Syria. This is really before the terrorist war got going. Though they were in there fiddling at all sorts of levels, BBC Media Action helped them write the handbook for journalists. So it's not just working with them. This is the BBC leading it. And here's BBC Media Action, and you can see the funding label for this thing. Now let's have a look at this. This same EU External Action, which is the European Foreign Office, has now set up what it calls disinformation review. So the European Union is now telling us what the truth is. You've got to see this. It's comic material. They're attacking at the moment the world according to the pro-Kremlin disinformation. Don't be deceived. Question even more. And there at the bottom, it says European External Action Services, which is the Foreign Office. So here they are. They say quite openly that they are really the European Union Diplomatic Service. And this is the situation. We've got all of that money now setting up a propaganda machine working directly with the BBC. Look how much. This is one project that organisation pays the BBC 2.4 million euros. Put the whole thing together. And what have we got here? We've got the BBC sitting at the centre of this phenomenal European propaganda machine. I would love to do some more research with you on this, and we hope to be able to do that. But it's becoming so blatant that the BBC has been working to help create the war, which it then reports And it doesn't even do that in an accurate way.
And I mean, we saw this in Libya as well. We saw it in Iraq. And also included in that media base is the French Foreign Office, of course, who also set up the Aleppo Media Center. That was actually the French Foreign Office media arm that created the Aleppo Media Center that is disseminating the White Helmet propaganda, among others. So, yeah, this is a very clear collusion on behalf of EU states, the UK, but particularly, as you say, the BBC. It's extraordinary, and I would love to further investigate it.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. Now, we should bring in David Ellis here, and we're going to be talking about the British nuclear deterrent again. David, before we get you on that subject, would you like to make any comment about the sort of areas that Vanessa's covered?
Well, it's as I said at the British Constitution meeting in Winchester, the Syrian affair, if we can call it that, is purely contrived. It's cooked up. There's obviously some variance there between Assad not wanting the Saudi pipeline and wanting the Russian pipeline. And that seems to be all to do with what's the problem in Aleppo. And it's a great political lever for the EU to be throwing in order to argue for its military union. So they're going to fund it, that being said, and they're going to throw a lot of money at it, and they're going to want it to happen because obviously it's vital for the bigger picture. It's almost like and I don't mean this in a demeaning way, but I can't think of any other way of phrasing it, a sprat to catch a mackerel.
Yes. Well, this ties in beautifully with your really outstanding report on what was happening with Britain's nuclear deterrent. This was the headline we pushed out yesterday. We discussed it with Alex Thompson from Eastern Approaches, exclusive the European Union to take control of the British nuclear deterrent. Now, all this stemmed from a paper that Strategic Defence Initiatives put together. We're just bringing the headline here, overview of the accelerating EU absorption of the British military to form the EU military and the British-French EU nuclear defence shield. This was the quote, which is an absolutely dynamite quote from a gentleman called Max Hoffman. He revealed on the 20th of January, everything must now be put on the table, from higher EU military spending to a, quote, British-French nuclear defence shield for the continent. Now, we've got Theresa May supposedly saying we've got Brexit. Mike's going to be talking about this a little in a few moments. But you reported here that the recent British Brexit referendum has made no difference to the speed and tenacity with which the Conservative government, Theresa May and Secretary of State for Defence Fallon, are continuing the path to EU military union. This is really astonishing. Just take us through a few of your thoughts on what's happening in the background here.
Well, what we've got is the Tory party as a whole is in absolute crisis, and it's been in crisis for many decades now because of this refusal of the majority of the party being aware of it or being able to discuss it. So we've got almost a tiny control group that are putting the block on this being debated and dialogue being opened up on it. Now, we know this is the case because of what went on with Maggie Thatcher and her saying no, 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 no. But the more important thing is, of course, is that the EU military union thing, which was on the table there in the 80s, and obviously we've got source back to the mid-40s and the late 40s, right to the sort of HQ there with Avril Harriman, the chief envoy for the Marshall Plan. So obviously we've got the whole chronology there. You can't argue with this. But what's happening within the Tory party is, of course, is that This could potentially be, if aired and waged properly, political dynamite and destruction for the party because of them refusing to talk about it and debate it, because they know damn well it's gone so far now, it would be an absolute vote killer at the ballot box. The British people will not support this, and that's why they won't talk about it. So they're in absolute crisis about it. Make no bones about it. This is why over the last 5 years, we've had, you know, absolute stonewalling from the vast majority of the party not wishing to discuss this. And this is because of this issue. It's not the crisis isn't the EU. The crisis is EU military union.
Yes.
And all the other stuff is all effectively, you know, just getting in the way. It's just blotting out the debate. It's like political radar jamming. So the key issue here is military union, because of the money involved with it and what it does for the currency and what it does for the big geopolitical situation in Europe. So coming back to the whole, you know, the EU military concept is lock, stock and barrel. It's everything. It's not just about sort of this nonsense of starting with EU NAVFOR. It's about our nukes. It always has been. So to say that it isn't is a nonsense. And this is the fundamental dilemma that they've got. And, you know, not dealt with, this is going to get a hell of a lot worse, because, you know, the attitude that they're displaying now is utter contempt for not just the Constitution, the armed forces, but the entire British people and the British nation.
Yeah, David, this is a very important point. There are a lot of people who don't like nuclear weapons, but the fact is that nuclear weapons exist. You can't just get rid of them. But the key issue here is the deceit of this whole thing. While Theresa May is saying she is bringing us out of the European Union, what is happening in the background, and you've absolutely nailed it with this report, is that the nuclear deterrent is being given, first of all, to the French. This is soft. This is a soft movement on the chessboard, because Britain would not react to the Germans. It goes to the French first, then it's passed to EU centralised control. But who is the military power in Europe? That is the Germans. So have you had any reaction from individuals? I know this report, which is available on the UK column website, if you click on the article, you can get a PDF version of it to download. What's been the reaction now that this has been pushed out? Have you had anything back from sort of senior military people, for example?
Yes, we have. We've got some very positive stuff back. Very quickly, and there's an awakening occurring, and some of them are dovetailing their own experience of being in Whitehall and in the services with actually the realities of really the bigger picture of what's going on. So the consensus at the moment is we've got a severe problem, a very severe problem, because if there's some sort of event where, and these are the words that have been used, bounced into this with Kent continuing down this avenue, which is being done all behind the scenes under the cover of Brexit, is that if we're bounced in, there isn't the current level of acumen and the right mindset within Whitehall to deal with this properly, where we'll end up, you know, properly coming unstuck and just surrendering our military and thereby the nation. So that was the first point that was made. And the second point was, well, that there was a consensus in Whitehall that we were never going to join anyway. So why pick the fight? Now, I've said, well, okay, I could accept that. That being the case would be wise counsel. But I don't believe that's the case, because from what we're seeing is that the controlling faction within the Tory party want to join. They want to join in with the EU military union, but they just have no idea how to do it openly and debate it, because they know damn well the British people won't support it. So this is why it's being done the way it is. So you've got this syndrome of the picking the fight. Well, actually, they've picked the fight with us. So we've got no choice. You know, when you get somebody pick a fight with you, you know, you can either run off, put your head in the sand, or you can stand up and fight back. And I think that this is the fundamental problem. We're not seeing enough standing up and fighting back. So I'm not accepting the one point that was made by an admiral, or, we don't need to pick a fight, because I think we do. We really do need to actually fight this. Otherwise, it's game over. And Brexit, what Brexit? Forget it, because this is what it's all about. All the other stuff is actually, you know, of lower importance and of lower grading. The key thing is the military. It always has been. This is why we've got this huge issue around it all the while. We've cut. Why have we cut? Russia's so bad. We've cut to join. And there's the faction there within the Tory party have made it so. And that's why they got rid of Maggie, clearly.
Yeah. Right. OK, with an eye on the title, I'll just say, and we should remember, of course, that Defence Secretary Michael Fallon, he was head of the European youth movement back in 1975. This man is a wolf in sheep's clothing. He's an absolute pro-EU man. And what we've got is complete deception of the British public. They are putting our nuclear deterrent into Europe at the exact time that they're standing publicly and saying we're coming out. It is outrageous. It's very, very dangerous. And for you to say that we've now got such low acumen, I think is the word you used, in the civil service and political services. We can't rely on people to see what's actually happening. My answer to that is we're going to have to keep pumping out the truth from UK column. David, thanks very much on that.
Well, maybe this gives us a clue, because this is the Institute for Government saying that this is the Whitehall Monitor 2017 report, and they're saying that the government basically doesn't have the people in the civil service, either the calibre or the numbers, to deal with the workload which is going to be generated by Brexit. Now, you could say on one hand that this is just more scaremongering, but, you know, you've just said something along those lines on the civil service. So perhaps this gives a little bit of backing to that. So do have a look at this report. They're saying that reduced staff numbers, operational budgets cut, and so on, means that getting ourselves extracted from the EU is pretty much too much to do. Well, okay. In the meantime, David Davis was up in Parliament today talking about the new EU bill, Article 50 bill, but he was also talking about the fact that the UK is going to tell the EU that they will have a trade deal before any kind of agreement on Brexit happens.
So I've got to say, Mike, this man is in Parliament talking about trade deals. That's what he's talking about in the public eye. And what's happening behind the scenes is the nuclear deterrent is being handed over to the European Union.
That's right.
This is, somebody said yesterday, it's like watching the magic roundabout.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They're going to give the Commons 5 days, apparently, to debate the new bill. The new bill has been published now. Well, let's have a look at it. Here it is. It says it's a bill to confer on the Prime Minister to notify under Article 50 of the Treaty of the European Union the United Kingdom's intention to withdraw from the EU, be it enacted by the Queen's Most Excellent Majesty by and with the advice and consent of the Lords Spiritual and Temporal and the Commons in this present Parliament assembled, and by the authority of the same as follows: pardon and notify withdrawal from the EU. The Prime Minister may notify under Article 50 of the Treaty on European Union the United Kingdom's intention to withdraw from the EU. Part 2 says this section has effect despite any provision made by or under the European Communities Act 1972 or any other enactment. Now, if you look at a lot of the mainstream media coverage of this, for example, I think it was the Daily Mirror, I think their headline was MP's Fury, that it was, as it was revealed today, that they'll get less than 2 weeks to study the bill. Now, I've just read the entirety of the bill in 30 seconds. And the mainstream media describing MPs being furious that they've only got 2 weeks to read that and understand it.
Well, David Ellis has just explained that. We've got MPs who haven't got the mental acumen to read a simple document.
Right.
That's where it is.
Yes. It's interesting. I'll just mention this to end off with. It is interesting that, in fact, there was a private member's bill put in by Peter Bone, who's just puts private members' bills in, as far as I can see, as he feels like it, that he produces hundreds of them each year, a slight exaggeration, but not much. Withdrawal from the Union, from the European Union, Article 50 Bill 2016-17. He put this in, I think, in November last year. It's had its first reading. It's having its second reading on the 24th of February. And it's interesting to compare the government's bill with Peter Bone's bill, because the only major difference in it is that he says that Her Majesty's government has a duty to notify the European Council by the 31st of March 2017 of the UK's intention to withdraw from the European Union. The new bill doesn't put any such time constraint on it, and I find that slightly interesting. I find two things interesting about it: the fact that the government felt that there was a need to produce a new bill when there's already a private member's bill in process, and also the fact that the new bill doesn't input any timescales on notification or any other thing.
Dragging your heels, Mike, because if they're going to get that nuclear deterrent across the front end, all of this leaving Brexit nonsense, doesn't matter. Drag your heels, obfuscate, delay, 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 because we're not coming out. We're being locked in.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to say we've been told, and we think there's some substance to it, that the UK column is now being watched on a daily basis by at least one member of the more senior BBC news team. Presumably they're watching us to learn how to report factual news. I wonder whether I could say, first of all, to David, assuming we've got the BBC actually watching us now, what would you say to the BBC about their failure, for example, to report accurately on what's happening with the nuclear deterrent?
Well, they have to wake up and realise that this information that's come through to us is very real and present. And we're talking about nuclear proliferation across a continent. So just very simply, you know, hands up, who thinks it's a good idea for the EU to have nuclear weapons? Someone answer me that. You know, let's see that at the ballot box under somebody's manifesto.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. And I'll do the same for you, Vanessa. BBC watching, what would you like to say to them?
Oh, I would love to say to them, why don't you go and meet the Syrian civilians that you purported to have protected and to be defending for the last 6 years, when in fact you criminally contributed to their misery, to their suffering, and to their incarceration under a Nusra Front terrorist-led extremist occupation of East Aleppo?
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much for that. Well, that brings us to the end of today's news. Thank you all very much for joining us. I'm going to say well done to the Totnes group that we understand had a successful meeting last night. This is people on the ground starting to say, we're not taking this anymore. We are going to do things. So well done. And of course, this can be replicated across the country. But if we don't speak out, if we don't take action, then of course we're complicit in what's happening. So expose it, get on the phone to Chris Leslie, be polite, but be firm that what he's doing is unacceptable. We'll be back same time tomorrow with David Scott. Thanks very much for joining us. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.